You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Susan Lax, co-owner of the famed Israeli footwear company Naot, and author of the lovely new book, A Heart's Landscape, An Introduction to a Garden of Moments. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We've just concluded the holiday of Passover, either last Friday night at sunset, if you are Reform or progressive or living in Israel, or Saturday night, last night, if you are conservative or Orthodox or living outside of Israel, say here in Tucson, Arizona, where I am. Actually, the restriction on eating chametz, that is non-matzah bread stuff, was complicated this year by the fact that Pesach began on a Friday night, which meant that, technically speaking, even if you were Reform or Progressive or living in Israel, you would have had a hard time finding fresh bread that wasn't either baked during Passover or on Shabbat. So I guess if you were fully observing the holiday of unleavened bread, you had to wait until last night to enjoy your first donut, pizza, or pasta. Anyway, the end of Pesach means that we have now moved in our ritual calendar to the period between Passover and Shavuot, in which for 7 weeks we fulfill an obscure religious rite by doing something called the counting of the Omer. This brief ceremony, really a blessing and a short statement of the date within the Omer period and the day and week we are tabulating, is a reminder of the fact that our Israelite ancestors brought a special grain offering, an Omer of barley, to the temple in Jerusalem every single day during this period. That mirrored the time between the Exodus from Egypt and the receiving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai that our even more ancient ancestors experienced. It is a reminder, too, this counting of the Omer, that we should learn to count every day so that we might make each day of our lives truly count. There are some wonderful cantorial settings for what is otherwise a brief ritual. We will hear one of them in our playout on Too Jewish today, but the dailiness of this simple rite has its own meaning. If we can remember to thank God each day, even in a brief way, then perhaps we can also remember the gratitude we feel for all the good and valuable gifts that God gives us every single day. On a lighter note, and to play us in this morning after Passover's over, here's Michelle Citron and her updated version of 20 more things to do with matzah after Passover's over.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? You can make some matzah cards and play with your friends, or you could wear a matzah costume for Burning Man. You could make a cover for your iPad or your iPhone. Stuff it in a pillow, it's better than foam. If your table is uneven, you can make a matzah shim. Or you could play a matzah football game and flick it to win. Make a matzah greeting card, a window cover for your car, a slide for your G.I. Joes. Make a matzah fan that blows. Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Go into your garden and spread some matzah mulch, or you can have a matzah contest for the loudest crunch. Make a matzah pyramid like our ancestors did, or you can make a matzah viewer box and watch an eclipse. crumble up some matzah to make drywall paste, or you can make a matzah backsplash and spruce up your place. Make a micro matzah brew, a palette for your reds and blues. Share it with those in need. There's so many mouths to feed, there's so much to do with all the matzah you have. And you can still eat it, cause it never goes bad.
That was Michelle Citrin, a past guest of Too Jewish, singing about 20 more things to do with leftover matzah after Passover's over. You know, like today. Susan Lacks, the co-owner of Na'ot, the famed Israeli footwear manufacturer, is also a spiritual guide and the author of a new book, A Heart's Landscape, An Introduction to a Garden of Moments. She'll join us and explain how this lovely book came to be. Don't miss it. When we come back in a moment, this morning here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Susan Lacks is the author of a beautiful new book, A Heart's Landscape, An Invitation to the Garden of Moments, which is just kind of part of her life. She's done many interesting things. She's co-owner of Na'ot Footwear, which if you've ever been in Israel and you didn't buy Na'ot, you probably made a mistake. Anyway, welcome to Too Jewish. Good morning.
Hi, thank you.
So, tell us a little bit about what prompted the creation of this, frankly, quite beautiful book, although it is not a coffee table book. It's not meant for that.
That's interesting. So many people, and that's what I love about it, that so many people find the book to be, have a position at a different place in their home. And some have said, it's the perfect place to be next to my bed. And someone said it's the perfect place to be on a coffee table. And here you're saying it's not a coffee table.
No, I like it. I think it's the kind of book you should pick up and read and not, you know, just kind of parse through because it's got pretty pictures. I mean, that's not the intent of it. So that's just my interpretation.
I love it. I love it. So A Heart's Landscape is a collection of my morning inspirations and my photographs. I've been writing a morning inspiration for the last 13 years. It goes out a couple of times a week all over the world to people who, the majority of them, I don't know who they are. But somehow it has found them. And it started out as a way to connect to a dear friend of mine who was touched by cancer and did not want to share that with anyone and discuss it and didn't want anyone coming over while she was going through her treatment. So I just sent her an email and I said, Stephanie, I'm going to be sending you an email. You can tell me to stop. You don't have to answer because I miss you and it's a way for me to connect to you. And I did that for, I guess it must have been 7 months. And then one day I got the flu. And she called me and she said, Susan, at 7:30 in the morning, where is my morning blessing? Huh. And it's then that I realized the power of words on someone's moment. And I started sending them out because the women I was working with as a spiritual counselor that were post and pre-mastectomies found out about it and said, we want it as well. And that's how morning inspiration was born. And over the years, people would say to me, why don't you put them in a book? And I kind of left it. And then COVID came and we were on lockdown. And I guess it was the right time.
It's a beautiful series of inspirational statements, poems, pictures, stories that help to kind of bring I don't know, as you say, a garden of moments, but maybe inspiration to each day. We will talk much more with Susan Lax about her book, A Heart's Landscape, An Invitation to the Garden of Moments, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Newish, progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. You can also call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Choya, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services with full music are available in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and there are a lot of them, are live and on Zoom. Access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish congregation in Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kfetch or a kfel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, TOOJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is a very popular podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, and over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, Our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about history, Jewish history, and history in the larger sense, and how we interpret it and see it. You know, since the 20th century, now 22 years in the past, there's been a real change in the way Jews look at history. There was the Holocaust and the founding of the State of Israel, and just a couple of years difference, really, in timing. That changed the way Jews looked at themselves all around the world. But Jews around the world looked at Jewish history in different ways already, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Israelis have their conception of Jewish history. Persian Jews have a completely different conception. Moroccan Jews have yet another conception.
And different groups of American Jews have different conceptions from one another.
Right. So, as we've said before in this series, history is very fungible. A lot depends on your perspective. And sometimes it is consciously rewritten. And sometimes there are parts of history that we're so uncomfortable with, we just don't want to confront them or grapple with them.
There are, you know, it's funny. I went to religious school in the 1960s and 70s, and my dad used to say, we are trying to raise an entire generation of American Jews on the Holocaust and the State of Israel, and maybe a couple of holidays thrown in. They really don't know anything else about Judaism. And I think while that wasn't universally true, that was kind of the focus. That's really what you learned about. Oh, we're learning about the Holocaust again this year. That's history, but it's just a kind of a slice of it. Is it important to see the broad sweep? I guess this is a softball question, but as opposed to just focusing on the issues that everybody likes to talk about, that everybody seems to want to focus on now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, those two events, which both occurred in the 1940s, the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel, are both part of a much broader context of Jewish history and a greater sweep. Think of how long we were exiled from the land of Israel and how much it took from so many different corners of the earth to bring about the conditions for the rebirth of the State of Israel. And in terms of the Holocaust, think about all the centuries of anti-Semitism and pogroms and inquisitions and other things that in some senses culminated with the Holocaust. And you can't understand either of those major events, really, without understanding a lot of other things about Jewish history, which too few people go into. You know, the history of our relationship with the Catholic Church, for example, is very important. But what most people know about that can be summed up in one sentence. They hated us. They tried to convert us. They failed.
And that's a piece of it. And so is the fact that often it was the Jews were actually protected by the church with all of the theological issues that were involved.
That's true, too.
And sometimes it was a local bishop or cardinal who protected the Jews against the mobs, and sometimes it was the friars who incited the mob. It's a really interesting and complicated story.
And sometimes Jews were protected by and defended by the Pope himself.
Correct.
You know, the famous papal enclave in the south of France called Le Comtat, because it was papal territory, Jews there were exempt from all the persecutions and pogroms that went on elsewhere in France, or elsewhere in Europe for that matter, because they were living under the direct protection of the Pope, who was aware of, the doctrine of St. Augustine about the witness people and thou shalt not kill them.
Yeah.
So
it's fascinating. And, you know, I think the way that people look at history is often out of ignorance more than anything else. The more that you learn about it, the more complicated and the richer it seems, and the more responsible you become, I believe.
I agree, and I think that at its best, history should teach us lessons about how we live our lives and how we move towards the future and how we create new history.
As we say in my business, God willing. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. And just as we have a lot of leftover matzah from Passover, we have a leftover joke from the Seder too. During a trip to London, I became friends with a very wealthy, very modest Jewish chap named Hyman Goldfarb. During one visit, Hyman told me that because of his large donations to many charities through the years, the Queen wanted to knight him, but he was going to turn the honor down. "That's a great honor," I said. "Why would you turn it down?" "Because in the ceremony you have to say something in Latin," he said. "I don't know any Latin." "So," I said, "say something in Hebrew. The Queen can't know the difference." "Brilliant," High complimented me, "but what should I say?" "Remember the question the son asked the father on the first night of Passover? Can you say that in Hebrew?" "Of course," he said. "Manishtana halayla azem ikol alelo." "Thank you, old sport. I'm going to become a knight." At the ceremony, High waited while several of the other honorees went before the queen. Finally, they called his name. He knelt before Her Majesty. She placed the sword on one shoulder and then the other, motioned for him to speak. And out came, "Manishtana halayla hazeh." The queen turned to her advisor and said, "Why is this night different from all the other nights?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Don't stop if you've heard it before. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Achrei Mot near the midpoint of the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. Leviticus is centered on the question of how to create holiness in our lives, and Achrei Mot addresses the issue in a variety of ways. It begins with words that are poignant without being revealing. "After the death of Aaron's two sons," it says, referring to Nadav and Avihu, the two priests who died in the Torah portion of Shmini earlier for offering strange and inappropriate fire to the Lord. "Aaron is enjoined to be cautious and scrupulous in all his observances, lest he incur a punishment similar to that of his sons." The portion then moves to the rituals related to the great and powerful Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, holiest day of the whole year for our ancestors, as it remains so for us. We're commanded to afflict our souls on that day, ta'anu et nafshotechem. The rites described in Achrei Mot are quite detailed and form the basis for the ways in which our ancestors observed the Day of Atonement throughout the period when the temple stood in Jerusalem. The high priest purified himself completely. Then he offered sacrifices of atonement for himself, for his family, and for his people. He would then purify the holiest parts of the shrine of the temple, bringing forward a goat as an atonement offering. The goat is one of the peculiarities of this ritual sequence. Actually, two goats are brought out. One, the scapegoat. This portion is the origin of that concept and that term. The scapegoat is given the burden of symbolically carrying the sins of the people out into the wilderness. The second goat is sacrificed as an atonement offering on the altar. Ultimately, after a day of self-denial and repentance, "Ki vayom hazeh yechaper alechem letaher etchem b'chol chatoteichem." On that day, atonement shall be made for you to purify you from all your sins. Through this process, we will be restored to holiness. Much of the rest of Achrei Mot reflects the ways in which we fail to remain holy and establishes rules to try to keep us on the straight and narrow. We're not to practice idolatry or engage in blood sports, nor eat carrion, and so on. Each prohibition is another way of structuring holiness into our lives, keeping us from engaging in unholy behaviors. Finally, Achrei Mot is interested in the question of establishing the prohibited degrees of marriage the people with whom we are not permitted to enter into matrimony, the laws of consanguinity and moral respect for those most closely related to us. In essence, the emphasis throughout this portion is on the ways in which we reestablish a close relationship with God, and so reacquire holiness. In a world today in which our focus can be so far from holiness, shaped by the daily details of our lives and the klaxon call of our commercial, complicated society, this emphasis on the sacred is striking. In the words of the psalm, "Keep yourself from evil, strive to do what is good and right. Seek holiness every day. Remove impurity from your life and embrace that which is sacred." Outstanding principles to live by today, too. When we come back here on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Susan Lax, tells us how she ended up owning Naot, the famed Israeli sandal and shoe manufacturer, and how her own spiritual work led her to create a remarkable new book. Find out all about it. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A Cleveland-area rabbi was arrested and suspended from his congregation after allegedly engaging in explicit online conversations and attempting to meet with an undercover investigator posing as a 15-year-old boy. Rabbi Stephen Weiss, who has served as senior rabbi at B'nai Jeshurun congregation in Pepper Pike, Ohio since 2001, was arrested last week by law enforcement officers with the Ohio Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. The 60-year-old had traveled to a prearranged location to allegedly engage in sexual activity with the purported child after communicating on a social networking app. Weiss was charged with one count of attempted unlawful sexual conduct with a minor, one count of importuning, soliciting sexual services, and one count of possessing criminal tools. Weiss posted a $50,000 bond. As a condition of his jail release, he must wear a GPS monitoring device. The day after his arrest, his congregation announced in an email to congregants it had suspended him from his position and barred him from the premises. B'nai Jeshurun President Rebecca Dorman and Senior Rabbi Hal Rudin-Luria, newly appointed to the position following Weiss's suspension, wrote the synagogue was unaware of any other alleged criminal incidents involving Rabbi Weiss. The synagogue said it would make confidential counseling available to congregants. "Our synagogue has been strong and vibrant for 156 years and faced many challenges along the way," they wrote. "We will continue on in that tradition as a synagogue family that supports and cares for each other in challenging times." Challenging times, indeed. The arrest comes amid a spate of recent revelations about misdeeds by rabbis in Ohio. In Toledo last month, Rabbi David Kaufman was arrested after being accused of rape. He was fired by a synagogue, which said the accusation did not involve a member of the congregation. And in Canton, Ohio, Rabbi John Adland was named in a Reform Movement report as having previously been engaged in misconduct involving a 14-year-old girl. In the latter case, congregants didn't learn about the rabbi's misdeeds while he served them. The community severed ties to Adlin after the release of the national report. A university in Oregon that fired a Jewish professor last year after he accused the school's president of making anti-Semitic comments violated the professor's academic freedom, according to a new report by a group representing university professors. The American Association of University Professors concluded that Linfield University, a private school in McMinnville, Oregon, violated academic freedom guidelines when it fired tenured English professor Daniel Pollack Pelsner a year ago. The report, released last week, also said the university contributed to a culture of abuse by its actions. Linfield fired Pollack Pelsner shortly after the professor went public with his accusations against the school's president, Miles K. Davis. He accused Davis of making multiple anti-Semitic comments to faculty, including commenting on the size of Jewish noses and making jokes about sending Jews to gas chambers. Pollack Pelsner also accused the school of covering up reports of sexual assault and instances of swastikas and other hateful messages painted on campus. The standoff attracted attention from many Jewish groups. The ADL and the Oregon Board of Rabbis both called on Davis to resign. Local outlets reported that members of the university community who rallied behind Pollack Pelsner were being intimidated into silence. Pollack Pelsner subsequently sued the university for $4 million for whistleblower retaliation and other claims. Meanwhile, a parallel investigation by the local NAACP found that Davis, who is black, had been subjected to racism at the university. It called the professor's allegations questionable. Now, the AAUP report corroborates much of Pollack Pelsner's allegations against the school. It details how Linfield forced him out of his job, locking him out of his email without first holding a disciplinary hearing required for charges against a tenured professor. It details how, as the school board's designated faculty trustee, Pollack Pelsner had reported several instances of sexual assault and harassment that were relayed to him, as well as instances of swastikas and racial slurs found on campus. He conveyed all these to the board. The allegations, the report says, were swept under the rug. Linfield, which is affiliated with the American Baptist Churches, did not participate in the investigation. In communications with faculty and local media, university spokespeople denied the allegations and indicated they were prepared to fight them in court. Pollack Pelsner's lawyer told Oregon Public Broadcasting that the AAUP report was a preview of what a jury would find in a court case against the university. Pollack Pelsner is currently a visiting scholar at Portland State University. And Marvin Chomsky often relayed one searing memory from the set of his 1978 miniseries, Holocaust. While shooting sequences in Austria dramatizing the mass murders of Jews at Nazi concentration camps and in the Babyn Yar Ravine outside Kiev, Ukraine, Chomsky recalled how a young camera operator challenged the narrative of what they were filming. "Mr. Marvin, you're making this up for the movie," the cameraman said, as Chomsky recalled in a video remembrance of his career for the Directors Guild of America. "This didn't really happen." So Chomsky turned to a nearby German crew member. "Is it true or not?" he asked. All eyes went right to him, and he thought and said in German, "Yes, that's true," Chomsky recalled. "All the kids, the young ones, just ran off crying their hearts out. They didn't believe it. I didn't have to say another word." Thanks to Chomsky, who died at the end of March in Santa Rosa, California, at the age of 92, the miniseries Holocaust showed millions of people, including 20 million Germans, that the Holocaust did indeed happen. When it aired in the U.S. and West Germany, the four-part miniseries attracted upwards of 120 million viewers, sparking broad public dialogue around the causes and consequences of the genocide of European Jews. Many Germans called into TV stations in tears, expressing shame at the events that were depicted on screen, and some former Nazi soldiers were even moved to confess details of their crimes. Frank Bosch, a German historian, said that he believes the miniseries broadcast on German TV in 1979, ranked alongside the Iranian Revolution and Margaret Thatcher's election as Prime Minister of Britain, as one of the key events of the year. The first major dramatization of the Holocaust, produced for a mass audience in the English-speaking world, the miniseries starred Meryl Streep and James Woods and tracked the lives of two fictional families in Nazi-occupied Germany, one Jewish, the second Christian, who eventually became Nazis. Covering a vast range of real-life Holocaust events, including Kristallnacht, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the concentration camps of Buchenwald, Auschwitz, and Sobibor, the Holocaust series was a revelation for many. It was controversial. Survivor Elie Wiesel, a past guest of Two Jewish, contended that the series trivialized its namesake atrocity. Hard not to. Still, Chomsky helmed all of it, from a script by Gerald Green, an experience his son Eric said left him traumatized. He won an Emmy for it, one of four he earned. Intuitively, he sensed that turning the monumental tragedy of the Holocaust into a simply family story would make it easier for the general public to grasp. "I said, I'm not doing a documentary. It's not even a docudrama. It's going to be a drama about people. And if you care about the people, you will watch." The Bronx-born son of Jewish parents who immigrated from Belarus, Chomsky started his career in TV in high school. After college and army service, he worked as an art director and set designer for shows, including Captain Kangaroo, transitioning to directing in the early 60s. In addition to Holocaust, Chomsky directed many other monumental TV projects, two episodes of Roots, for example. He helmed various installments of Star Trek, too. Chomsky directed other Jewish-themed projects as well, including Victory at Entebbe, TV movie about Operation Entebbe, and Inside the Third Reich, a 1982 TV movie based on the memoir by Albert Speer, Hitler's architect. But Holocaust was where Chomsky made his biggest mark on the culture, a mark that will not soon be forgotten. In 2019, German TV re-aired the series, marking its 40th anniversary. And he passed away a few weeks ago, and we remember him this week, in which we commemorate Yom HaShoah on Thursday. The historian Bosch recalled survivors came to the Auschwitz trials and journalists didn't even interview them. Nobody cared about the victims. Well, that changed with the miniseries Holocaust. May Chomsky rest in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Susan Lax is the author of A Heart's Landscape, An Invitation to the Garden of Moments, a book of inspirational statements that began as a way of helping a friend and has the capacity to help open us up a little bit. Your own experience is varied. That's putting it mildly. You have a teaching degree in creative drama from the Kibbutzim College of Education, Technology, and the Arts. You taught creative drama at a variety of levels. In addition, you studied Jewish healing, psychology, sacred psychology, some mysticism, you're a spiritual counselor, and somehow or other, you're the co-owner of Naot Footwear. How does all that get integrated, madam?
Well, it gets integrated because we all have stories, right? That's what we're all made of, our stories. And those are just different pages in my story. I grew up on a kibbutz in Israel. And then before I went into the army, I did a year of service and moved to another kibbutz, Kibbutz Gezer. And there I met my husband.
I know Kibbutz Gezer. It's named for a carrot, but it's really not. It's in near a very interesting Philistine dig. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yes. And my husband was one of the people that started that kibbutz. And I ended up doing the army and staying there and marrying with two kids, came to the States and because my husband was ill. But in the meanwhile, I studied to become a teacher's creative drama for teacher in another kibbutz. I then came to the States, and we were supposed to stay here for 2 years, but he got well, and we decided not to play with fate and stay where he was healthy. And it's a long story how Naot came into us, but we were importing leather jackets. And nobody was ordering again. They were all very nice to us. And someone said, hey, do you know where to get Neot sandals from? And my sister had married someone and was living there at Kibbutz Neot Mordechai. And he said, sure. And we worked with Neot for years. We started a business, and we became probably their biggest part of their business. And then about 9 years ago, in order to keep the company in Israel and not let it be bought out and moved to China, because we wanted it to stay in Israel, in the northern part of Israel, and to continue to employ all the people that live there, we bought the company and now are co-owners of the worldwide company.
Yeah, and if you've ever been in Israel, Naot kind of took over the footwear industry there. And the only problem with Naot footwear is it doesn't wear out. you guys would...
People tell us that.
You'd make a lot more money if you went with the American process of planned obsolescence. So it's a great story. Very Israeli-American kind of entrepreneurial story in its own way. Heart's Landscape, back to your book. There's a series of photographs within it. It's obviously easier to make a book without elaborate pictures. Tell us where the pictures come from.
So probably about 6 years ago, I'm a spiritual counselor, and I help people that have been touched by cancer and then I also guide them to exit this world. And I was in need of more inspiration myself. And I just started taking photographs. And I found myself being so uplifted by them. I started adding them to my morning inspiration. And, you know, it's all about a moment of awareness. And I found that the photographs allowed me or invited me to have a moment of awareness wherever I was. And I started adding it to morning inspiration. And people were writing back to me saying, wow, that photo really moved me. And I realized that there was inspiration in photos as much as in words. And that's where they're from.
So tell us how one becomes, I mean, speaking as a rabbi, we think of that as related to spirituality. I can't help think that way. Tell us how somebody becomes a spiritual counselor.
Oh, wow. So I have to tell you, it's when I translated into Hebrew, Yoetzet Ruchanit, it doesn't sound as well as in English.
You know, it's funny because in Hebrew, Ruchanit, that's kind of a new word in Hebrew. The whole notion of spirituality, there's no ancient Tanakhit, there's no biblical or Talmudic word for spirituality in Hebrew.
Nahon. And so here in Israel, you know, you're talking to me, I'm in Tel Aviv, and Ruchani has another meaning to it. It's almost like very out there a little bit.
Yeah.
And there's no other translation. And so it's more like, so the spiritual counselor part that I came across was that I just went to study Jewish spirituality. Because as a kibbutznikit, I was not very attached to my Judaism. And living in the United States, when I was a minority, I felt that I needed to somehow figure out where is that going to fit in my life. You know, the first time I walked into a synagogue was when I moved to the United States. I had never been to one. And it started becoming interesting to me. And in my studies at the time at Chochmat Talev, I started all this and became a spiritual counselor, which was really just allowing people to tap into their spirituality. You know, people sometimes say to me, I'm not spiritual, but I say to them, but you have a spirit. You just have to tap into it. So it's more of a guidance. And sometimes therapists will send them to me to figure out. I work on a day-to-day basis. It's not what was or what will be. It's what it is today, in our moments today.
Your friend who helped motivate you to create this Heart's Landscape book says, where's my morning blessing? It's like the Birchot HaShachar, really the blessing of the morning that you were creating. You've completed this book, right? That makes it a fixed kind of thing. Do you still go back to it, or do you always try to create something fresh?
Oh, I love that question. Nobody has ever asked that, and I appreciate it. So mostly, every time I write a morning inspiration, it's a new one. But there are times that, remember, when I wrote this book, I had to go through 3,684 morning inspirations and narrow it down. So I guess there's like 130 here, maybe.
Yeah.
I have many morning inspirations from years past, but, you know, I have evolved. My writing has evolved. My readers have evolved, and the world has evolved. So most of my morning inspirations are from what's going on now in my moment. However, I do go back, and I look at the ones in the past, or in my book, or in my past morning inspirations that did not enter the book for various reasons, and I sometimes rewrite them, and a whole new inspiration comes.
I have to say, as a rabbi, I go back, I'll pull up an old sermon on a particular parsha, a weekly portion, and then I'll revise it, rewrite it, change it, because I'm not the same person I was when I first had those thoughts 10 years ago. Now, I know you're not supposed to pull stuff out of your file as a rabbi, but if you're looking for spiritual inspiration, I think it's okay to go back to your own stuff, isn't it?
Oh, that's so true. Because when I go back, I usually pull something that moves me, that still moves me, that still inspires me, and I create it differently. I connect it to my now moment.
Question about some of your work as a spiritual counselor. You mentioned you help people to die. Having been present with people who've died, my experience is different from, for example, how they describe it in the Zohar, the soul hovering over. I mean, I always feel like when they're gone, you just kind of know they're gone. What's your experience of that, if it's not too personal a question?
No, it's not at all personal. And, I have to say you are the first rabbi that I'm talking to in this book tour interviews, and it's quite wonderful to be able to share some things and not have to explain them too much. So thank you for bringing that up.
Sure.
I really do believe that when someone exits, and when I've been with them as they exit this world, I kind of do believe that the soul hovers. And I think that that's what is so wonderful in the Shiva, that there's something about sitting in the Shiva and the soul hovering, making sure that those that are mourning are taken care of. And when I work with someone and I tell them they're just exiting, they're going out, but they're not going to just rush away and close the door and say, I'm not here anymore. And I find that to be quite comforting, both for the person who is exiting and for the people that are saying goodbye. Because I kind of think, from my own experience of people that I've had to say goodbye to, it was very comforting to know that it wasn't just a goodbye like the door slamming. It was, we're walking away slowly, and you don't have to just forget and move.
The creation of a Heart's Landscape, it's a labor of love, right? Has to be.
Totally.
And I know this is new, right? You still have another 9 years and 6 months of these in store. Can we? Are you thinking about another book?
So I've been asked that a lot, And my immediate answer was, you don't ask a woman who just gave birth when she's going to have her next child.
That is certainly true. I can, as a father of three kids, I can tell you there was no immediacy to the desire for another child right after birth. I think that's a great analogy.
But I'm already now past a little bit. You know, the book came out in January. And I think that I would like maybe to sit with the thought and to figure out what I would do with the ones I'm creating now. And will it be the same? Will it be smaller? People have asked me and said, you know, we're bringing it to the hospital and we're reading it to someone there. And it's too heavy for them to hold. Or I've heard people that are ill and say, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah,
it is all different ways to go with this. But for now, I'm enjoying the infancy of the book and learning how to be with it and to see other people be with it. And I know that for me, when I get a phone call or an email or WhatsApp that says to me, wow, this book is part of our healing process, that to me is what my intent was. My intent that it would reach people and be a hand to be held when we needed one. You know, there's no task in this book. There's no real beginning and real no end. You know, it's when you open the book and you turn it to wherever it is and your finger lands wherever it is, that's what is there for you to say at that moment.
I want to thank Susan Lax for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called A Heart's Landscape, An Invitation to the Garden of Moments. Wonderful book. Where can people go to find out more about you and more about the book?
So I love when people visit SusanPlax.com and leave me a message. I love to hear from all the wonderful human spirits that are in the world.
And buy Nowed Footwear, by the way. I should also throw that in. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Maggie Anton, author of the Rashi's Daughters series and a new book, The Choice, a novel of love, faith, and the Talmud. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes, as promised, from cantor Moshe Stern, his rendition of the classic cantorial piece, Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, May the Temple Be Rebuilt, a text used during this period as we count the Omer between Passover and Shavuot. My friends, may you have a healthy week, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we profoundly pray of peace. Thank you.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.